This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Anatomy of Terror, written by Ali Soufan, performed by Aaron Abano.
Now the Hydra had a huge body, with 9 heads, 8 mortal, but the middle one immortal. By pelting it with fiery shafts, he forced it to come out, and in the act of doing so, he seized and held it fast. But the Hydra wound itself about one of his feet and clung to him. Nor could he effect anything by smashing its heads with his club, for as fast as one head was smashed, there grew up 2. Pseudo Apollodorus, The Library, Book 2, Chapter 5. A note on sources. I have spent more than 2 decades investigating and analyzing Al-Qaeda and its offshoots. As a result, I have developed a considerable degree of familiarity with the organization's structure, methods, and narratives. With that knowledge as my guide, I consulted thousands of documents, including previously classified material, and the writings, both public and private, of the terrorists themselves, alongside the best secondary sources, including research carried out by my organization, the Soufan Group. I also conducted interviews with knowledgeable individuals, many of whom bore painful witness to the events described. From this diverse array of sources, I have attempted to piece together the most comprehensive, detailed, and accurate account possible. On the few occasions where I have made assumptions in order to bridge evidential gaps, I have said as much, either in the main text or in the notes that follow the text. Introduction. Friends and Enemies. On a crisp morning in December of 2001, I picked up a pockmarked clay brick, one of thousands like it littering the site of what only weeks before had been a hideout for the most wanted man on earth. Perhaps, I thought, this very brick had formed part of the wall of Osama bin Laden's sleeping quarters, or the floor where he habitually sat to receive visitors. As I felt the heft and contour of that brick in my hands, I contemplated the unlikely sequence of events, some in my lifetime, others over long centuries, that had brought me to that extraordinary time and place. I was born in Lebanon, emigrated to America, and went to college and then grad school in Pennsylvania. I took a double major in political science and international relations, with a minor in cultural anthropology, and followed that up with a master's in foreign relations. With the Cold War freshly over, and America's position as the world's only superpower seemingly secure, it was tempting to conceive of the world as a complex but orderly machine, in which nation-states would set rational policies, and those rational policies would dictate logical strategies. Yet there was something fundamentally unsatisfying about this clockwork view of the world. From my graduate studies, one prominent counterexample stuck in my mind, one from 2,500 years ago. The Peloponnesian War pitted Athens' Delian League against a coalition of states led by Sparta and eventually aided by the mighty Persian Empire. After a quarter century of alarms and reversals, Athens finally surrendered. By paving the way for Alexander's unification of Greece and his subsequent conquests, the war changed the course of European and world history. But the outcome was by no means foreordained. I came to see that all the key decisions were based neither on policy nor on strategy, but on personalities. Speeches and emotional appeals consistently carried the day. Half a millennium later, Cato the Younger would mark this same phenomenon in Rome's rocky transformation from republic to empire. "When Cicero spoke," he said, "people marveled. When Caesar spoke, people marched." Theories are great tools to think with. They open your mind, broaden your perspective. But it is people who make the world go round, individual human beings, with all their idiosyncrasies and contradictions and baggage, with their ideas sculpted by culture and belief and education and economics and family. are the agents of every grand historical force that future generations will see smoldering in the tangled wreckage of the past. While I was still a student, I began following through the Arabic press the exploits of a dissident Saudi millionaire named Osama bin Laden and his nascent extremist organization, Al-Qaeda, the base. I marveled at this man's audacity in declaring war on America and his charismatic ability to attract followers to his side. But my own calling could not have been more different. Fresh out of grad school, I joined the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where one of my first assignments was to write a paper on this man bin Laden and his group. My report came to the attention of John O'Neill, the legendary head of the Bureau's counterterrorism section, based in Manhattan. In time, John became my mentor and a close friend. When suicide bombers murdered 17 American sailors aboard the USS Cole in October 2000, John assigned me to lead the investigation. I traveled to Sana'a, Yemen's ancient capital, and began running down leads and interrogating suspects. John O'Neill retired from the Bureau in the summer of 2001. I took him out to lunch to celebrate and told him I was getting married. He gave me his blessing. But this would prove to be our last meeting. On August 23rd, John became security director for the World Trade Center. 2 weeks later, he died, rushing back into the South Tower, courageous to the very end, determined to do what he had been doing his whole career, save lives. 3 months later, standing with my colleagues in the remains of bin Laden's bombed-out Kabul compound, I felt myself overcome by a strong sense of revenge for my country, for the thousands murdered, and especially for John. Ever since the attacks, the Al-Qaeda leader had been confidently predicting America's imminent downfall. Now bin Laden and his extremist cohorts were learning that the United States and its broad coalition of allies would not give in to terrorism so easily. For now, the Sheikh still evaded capture, but the tide had turned. The piles of rubble, the lone wall that remained of a sizable residence, the twisted metal of what had once been a staircase, the smattering of airdropped leaflets offering $25 million for information leading to bin Laden's capture, all bore witness to the turn of fortune's wheel. Back home in the United States, some political leaders were already talking about Afghanistan as a future democratic beacon for the region. In the decade that followed, my life changed utterly. I spent another 4 years with the FBI investigating the 9/11 attacks and other terrorist crimes. I got married, left the Bureau, and eventually became the father of three very energetic boys. And so it was that on a Sunday evening in the spring of 2011, I found myself at home, assembling a pair of swing seats for our newborn twins as the television chattered away in the background. At around 9:45 p.m., a special announcement broke through the babble. The president would shortly be addressing the nation. Clearly something big had happened. It was 11:35 p.m. by the time President Obama approached a podium in the East Room of the White House and confirmed to the world that U.S. Navy SEALs had killed Osama bin Laden. As the president spoke of the people bin Laden had murdered, of the families bereaved, of the children left fatherless, my thoughts turned again to John O'Neill and the other friends I had lost along the way. Near the end of his remarks, Obama said, "Justice has been done." That was certainly true, but the ramifications of bin Laden's demise had yet to play out. Would the jihadist edifice simply crumble without its keystone? Or would bin Laden prove more powerful as a martyr than he ever had been as a living leader? No doubt these questions were on the president's mind, too. ABC News' Martha Raddatz had reported absolute jubilation throughout government. For my part, I could not help but feel more troubled than jubilant. Emails began flooding my inbox from friends and colleagues congratulating me and from reporters seeking my take on events. An editor from the New York Times asked if I would put my views in an op-ed for the paper. I sat down to analyze the situation. I thought of all the dozens of Al-Qaeda acolytes I had interrogated over the years, playing high-stakes games of mental chess with extremists and murderers for the sake of extracting priceless evidence. They had pledged bayat to bin Laden, swearing allegiance neither to the office nor the organization, but to the man himself. To whom would zealots such as these now declare fealty? Osama bin Laden had been uniquely well-equipped to lead the network he founded. He had walked away from the wealth and luxury of the Saudi upper crust in order to devote himself to jihad, against the Soviets and then against America. This personal history helped him in two ways. First, his freely chosen asceticism helped inspire fanatical devotion among his followers. Secondly, at the same time, his privileged background endowed him with contacts among wealthy elites willing to bankroll terrorism. Bin Laden's death would therefore leave a gaping hole in Al-Qaeda's recruitment and fundraising efforts. It seemed likely that bin Laden's longtime deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, would be named the new emir. If so, I knew that he would struggle. To be sure, Zawahiri is clever and strategic. He is, after all, a fully trained surgeon who honed his militant skills battling the Sadat and Mubarak regimes in his native Egypt. He is also a zealot of uncompromising brutality, responsible more than anyone for justifying the tactic of suicide bombing, and by extension, for the tragic toll it has taken on innocent Muslims. But for all his intelligence, his cunning, and his zeal, Zawahiri possesses none of the charisma bin Laden had. Indeed, his personality has alienated many people over the years. More importantly still, Zawahiri is an Egyptian. Within Al-Qaeda, his appointment would inflame the already tense internecine rivalry between his countrymen and the Gulf Arabs who make up the jihadi rank and file. As an organization, then, Al-Qaeda was in deep trouble. But what of bin Ladenism as an idea? That, I felt, was a different story. I feared that some of the regional groups that bin Laden had worked so hard to keep in line, like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, AQI, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM, and Al-Shabaab in the Horn of Africa, would split off. They might even intensify their ideology. No doubt they would see the nascent Arab Spring as an opportunity to impose their ideas on their fellow Muslims. In the pages of the New York Times, I wrote, "We cannot rest on our laurels. Most of Al-Qaeda's leadership council members are still at large, and they command their own followers. They will try to carry out operations to prove Al-Qaeda's continuing relevance. And with Al-Qaeda on the decline, regional groups that had aligned themselves with the network may return to operating independently, making them harder to monitor, and hence deadlier." It brings me no pleasure to see those premonitions borne out. Al-Qaeda has indeed fractured into regional units. Zawahiri, the cold bureaucrat, has struggled to maintain control. Meanwhile, the cancer of bin Ladenism has metastasized across the Middle East and North Africa and beyond, carried by even more virulent vectors. Whereas on 9/11, Al-Qaeda had around 400 members, today it has thousands upon thousands, in franchises and affiliates spread from the shores of the Pacific to Africa's Atlantic seaboard. And that is without even counting the breakaway armed group that calls itself the Islamic State. Al-Qaeda's Syrian branch alone has more members than bin Laden ever imagined for his entire network. It is striking to note that in October of 2015, more than 14 years after the 9/11 attacks, U.S. forces disrupted what is believed to be the largest Al-Qaeda training camp ever, all 30 square miles of it, right in the organization's historic heartland of Afghanistan. In the Middle East, the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda's most vicious offshoot to date, employs methods so savage that even hardened terrorists publicly denounce their brutality. Where bin Laden encouraged militants in his network to focus on attacking the West directly rather than hitting regimes in the Muslim world, the Islamic State has successfully done both. It has brought mass murder to the streets of Paris, airports in Brussels and Istanbul, a Russian airliner in the skies over Sinai, and a Christmas market in Berlin. It has killed worshippers at mosques in Yemen and Kuwait, attacked police, soldiers, and border guards in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and bombed political rallies in Turkey. At the same time, it has conquered millions of acres across Iraq and Syria, aided by tens of thousands of foreign recruits. The organization's formal break with Al-Qaeda in 2014 has not stopped the Islamic State from expanding to other troubled regions of the world, most notably Libya. The group has even established a beachhead in remote regions of Afghanistan, where it vies violently for control with Al-Qaeda's long-standing allies, the Taliban, who governed Afghanistan until the United States removed them from power in 2001. A video popular among Muslims living in the projects of East London, Birmingham, and elsewhere in England shows a man squatting in a Syrian field, his features covered with a ski mask, his rifle at the ready. Fighting in the Levant is not as easy as pulling out your 9mm on a back road of the streets of London and blasting a guy, he says in a forthright East London accent. It's not as easy as putting up your feet on the couch after a hard day's work on the corner. Inspired by such bin Ladenist propaganda, as many as 38,000 foreigners had joined the fighting in Syria by the end of 2015. Compare that to the Afghan jihad against the Soviets, which attracted only 8,000 foreign nationals. And whereas those who made the journey to that conflict came overwhelmingly from Muslim-majority countries, the war in Syria has attracted over 5,000 foreign fighters from the United States and the European Union, as well as many hundreds from Russia. Around 20-30% of these fighters have already returned home. Not all of them are plotting violence by any means. But the numbers are so great that even if only a small proportion of these fighters emerge from the conflict as hardened terrorists, it could spell big trouble for the West. How big? Think of it this way. The Islamic State's attack on Paris in November of 2015, in which 130 innocent people died, were perpetrated by just 9 men. My first book, The Black Banners, told the tale of Al-Qaeda up to the death of its founder. In this book, I aim to take the story further. True to my conviction that personalities matter, I will focus my story through the eyes of several key individuals, notably bin Laden himself, Saif al-Adl, his wily security chief, Ayman al-Zawahiri, his deputy and successor, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the Jordanian militant who founded the organization that would become the Islamic State, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the group's current caliph, and the men, and in bin Laden's case, the women, of their inner circles. Through these characters, we will trace the transformation of Al-Qaeda as an organization, the simultaneous development of bin Ladenism into a far more potent and lethal force, the rise and decline of the Islamic State, and the impending resurgence of Al-Qaeda. In its landmark final report, the 9/11 Commission concluded that the tragic attacks of September 2001 were allowed to proceed in part because of a catastrophic failure of imagination on the part of U.S. intelligence. Analysts commonly asserted that they simply couldn't imagine someone flying a plane into a building. In a similar vein, a month before the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz told a Senate panel, "It's hard to conceive that it would take more forces to provide stability in post-Saddam Iraq than it would take to conduct the war itself and to secure the surrender of Saddam's security forces and his army." It took less than 2 months and minimal U.S. casualties to conquer the country. Yet 8 years, 5,000 coalition deaths, and $1.7 trillion were nowhere near enough to provide stability in post-Saddam Iraq. "Know your enemy," Sun Tzu admonishes us across the millennia, and yet time and again, when inquiries are held and hard questions asked, the response amounts to, "We couldn't conceive, we couldn't imagine, we couldn't wrap our heads around the possibility that something like this could happen." or just as bad. We did imagine some worst-case scenario, and therefore it was sure to happen. As in the so-called 1% doctrine espoused by Vice President Dick Cheney, who told Americans, "If there is a 1% chance that Pakistani scientists are helping al-Qaeda build or develop a nuclear weapon, we have to treat it as a certainty in terms of our response. It's not about our analysis. It's about our response." That is the high road to an absurd and ruinous waste of finite intelligence, military, diplomatic, and law enforcement resources. The key to a more constructive use of our imaginations is empathy, not in the colloquial sense of sharing another person's perspective, but in the clinical sense of being able to see the world through another person's eyes. Sadly, after 15 years of the war on terrorism, we still do not really know our enemy in this deeper sense. In this book, by delving into the personalities of men who mean us harm, I aim not to create sympathy for them, far from it, but to help point the way to a deeper understanding of their worldview, their motivations, and how best to combat the destructive ideology they represent. I still have that battered clay brick I picked up in bin Laden's shattered hideout. A decade and a half later, it sits on a shelf in my office in Midtown Manhattan. Looking at it while I work reminds me of the progress we have made against terrorism since I first picked it up on that winter morning, but also of the missteps we have made along the way, and above all, of how far we still have to go. We have killed the messenger, but the message lives.